So, yeah, I want to thank you all for hearing me speak. Our original title was Sleepless in Seattle, Forms and Distributions of Non-Monogamy. Since then, Since then, we've had a bit of title creep. I think a better title for what I'm actually going to be talking about, why is it doing that, is Potential Implications of Different Empirical Mixing Patterns. So, unknowingly, the three talks we have today fit really well together. The first talk assessed how to assess if there is disparity in a population in terms of STD risk. The second, what do we do with that in terms of a program science perspective? And what I'll be talking about is how did this, explaining how this potential disparity could have come about. So they actually fit really well together. And so this is my outline. But I'd like to begin on a bit of a philosophical note. So this is Magritte, and this is his painting, The Treachery of Images. And if you know, if your French is any good, this says, this is not a pipe. And what he means is this is not a real pipe. This is but an image, or a synthetic pipe, or a model of a pipe. And so what this means is when we generate these infection transmission models, what comes out is not a real sexual network. It's a model of that. It's a synthetic representation of a real process. But so all models are necessarily wrong in some way. So does that mean all models are completely useful? There's no utility? Well, I hope not, because I would be out of a job. But so this is this slide is a simplification, and I'll provide a simplification of the simplification that this describes the relationship between data and theory. So with models, let me erase this microphone. With modeling, one thing we can do is make predictions about what we would expect to happen in terms of disease prevalence in different population groups given different conformations of the system. And so we make these predictions and we go into the real world and we take in empirical data and we say, do these things make sense together or is there a disagreement? If they make sense together, well, it's kind of boring because that means our theory is adequate to explain what's going on. Now, what's more interesting with the magic of science here is when there's a disagreement, because that means we either have to refine our theory, we have to go back to the drawing board and make a refinement, or perhaps we have to refine our data collection methods, because perhaps this disagreement results from some sort of bias, some sort of noise that's being introduced into the system based on information bias, selection bias, normal epi stuff. So what are some observations in STD theory here? So for example, why is there a higher STD prevalence among the young? I recommend you attending the presentation by Christine Ross. She gives the state of chlamydia in the United States, and not to give part of her part of it away is that among the young there's a much higher prevalence of chlamydia in the U.S. It's roughly 14%. There's a very strong age effect. It decreases as age increases. So how did this come about? Are these younger people making riskier decisions? Maybe. Are they more susceptible to infection? Maybe. Are they using condoms less often? These would all explain it quite easily. Now, what I'm going to assume is that no, these people are acting in the exact same way, but perhaps it's a structural feature. Perhaps it's how people are mixing that is causing this disparity. So mixing is really difficult to understand, and hopefully you'll see that very shortly. It's very difficult to understand, very difficult to study empirically, and that's where we need models. Our human brains just cannot put all this together. That's where we need models that have a set of rules, and they give an output from that. So what I will be doing, talking about today, is relating empirical mixing patterns to specific theoretical implications in terms of STD prevalence and risk. To do this, I'll be using a data set very similar to the NATSOL data set from the UK, but the 2003-2004 Seattle Sex Survey, where we looked at these mixing patterns, and then I relate these to random proportionate mixing just to get an understanding of is there a preference or is there an aversion between specific groups. And then finally, what are the effects of these mixing patterns on disease outcomes and amenability to specific interventions? So the prior models were all equation-based models. This model is a little different. It's kind of like The Sims. So I have a bunch of little discrete people in this computer world, and each person, you know, they follow a set of rules. They have demographic transition. They form and dissolve heterosexual partnerships, and they can transmit and recover from infection. So I'll just try and go through these briefly. The one technical slide is right here, that to do this I used the Gillespie exact method, and all I want to say about that is that this is a continuous time approximation where no two events can occur at the same time, and there's technical reasons to do it that way. So demographic transition. So we have these people, we have these little people bugs, and they're gradually getting older as you move down, and they are gradually acquiring education. What we did to fit this in the model to the census data, we found that we could actually, we didn't need to model education progression in people older than 30, that basically all the education progression happened before then. There are exceptions, but this is the general rule. And also note that you can't get younger, as much as we all would like to go up the path here. And you also cannot lose education, as much as we might think certain people have. But you can get older, you can gain education. And so just to show you what we did, on the left is the census data in King County, Seattle. And you see the four different age groups, 18 to 24 and so forth, in the rows. And the color coding along the top is the level of education. And so, anyway, we fit this fairly well. There were some issues because the census population, what you see, where's the pointer, is that the oldest age group, there's actually a higher proportion of people 35 to 39 in the lowest education category. This cell is larger than this cell. What that means is that did those people lose education? No, you can't lose education. This implies that this system is not at equilibrium. This means that education policies have changed over time, or people's willingness or desire to go to college has changed over time. But so because of that, you know, we weren't going to be able to fit this census data exactly. So what we have is over there on the right, and just to note, though, that you can think of these as denominators, that there's a very large group of people 18 to 24 in that lowest education category, and that, for example, the 25 to 29 group with greater than college education, it's a very small set of people. So it's a smaller pool if you're trying to mix with only those people. It's a very small pool to find. Just trying to go through these model events. The next set of events is sexual partnership formation and dissolution, and I'll try and go through this quickly. Basically, there's a set of lists that, like, I'm looking for sex partners. I'm a male or a female, and I'm looking for sex partners. And what we do is we draw random males and females, and we say, are they a good match? And how do we determine if they're a good match? Well, they have to have a probability vector of, I've chosen this kind of person, am I going to accept you or not? And if you have a flat probability vector for that, that basically says I'm just as likely to mix with someone 18 to 24 with less than high school as I am someone 35 to 39 with greater than college. So it's a lack of preference, basically. We can also think of other mixing strategies where there's strict age mixing, where you only mix among the same age group, strict education mixing, only mixing with people of the same education status, and then strict age and education combined. Now, how did we use the Seattle data? We examined what were the observed mixing patterns from that, who was having sex with whom based on age and education. So these are basically dirtier versions of those strict age and education mixing patterns, because it's not a flat, you could still mix with someone in different categories. It would just be unlikely. One little bit of background on the Seattle Sex Survey. This is a random digit dial, so this is not a random sample. We used roughly the 1,000 participants that gave us info on their most recent sex partner. We categorized them based on their age and education, and we categorized their partners based on age and education. We couldn't consider race because this sample was roughly 92% white, and so once you start splitting boxes, for the N becomes quite small. But you could think of doing a similar analysis if you had the data to include other categories such as race. And so this is a mixing matrix. This, I'm not sure if the colors there, you can't quite see it. But so this is for women who are 18 to 24 and are college educated, this is who they mixed with. And so what you see, so you see a strong age assertive mixing in the among 18 to 24-year-old women, you see a strong age effect in the bluer colors there, particularly in the with college education and some college. But you also see an education effect that as you go down the line of that these women were partnering with men who had college degrees but were in these other age groups as well. So there's an age and an education effect that we observed from the Seattle data set. And we're not going to go into this too much, but so this is a matrix of matrices, and so you can look at, this is where we were. There's the women who are college educated, 18 to 24. Each category has its own mixing matrix. This gets really complicated really quickly. But I'll focus your attention to say the corners. And in those corners, you see that women who were young with low education were partnering generally with men who were young with low education. Women who were older with the max education were generally partnering with those kinds of people as well. Here's the same thing for men. Again, just briefly looking at the corners, you see the same phenomena. So these male and female, they've decided to form a partnership. Well, is it going to be a long-term, steady partnership or a casual partnership? And so, basically, I'm assuming that everyone in this model uses the same rules to decide this. So, they have an 80% chance of forming a casual partnership. So we're going to form a partnership, and 80% of the time, it's going to be a casual, short-term partnership. The other 20% of the time, it'll be a long-term partnership. So, if this new partnership is steady, if it's a long-term partnership, we remove these people from the pool of available partners unless they're core group members. So the core group members are the ones these are the higher-risk people, and they stay in that pool. They're still looking for sex partners. And the core group members, they're just as likely to be in any of the age and education categories. So there's not an association between core group status and age and education status, because we're trying to keep people as similar to one another as possible. So non-monogamy or concurrency is possible in this model due to the presence of either casual partnerships, because when you're in a casual partnership, you're not removed, you're still looking for more sex partners, and also the presence of these core group members. Partnership dissolution is much more simple. These short-term partnerships lasted, we assumed, on average about 10 days, sometimes more, sometimes less. And the steady partnerships were much longer, 7 years on average. And I won't go into the transmission and recovery, but basically you had to be in a partnership to transmit. If you're in a casual partnership, we assumed that the rate of sexual activity was higher, thus the transmission rate was higher while in that partnership. And then we also took into account symptomatic status in these men and women when we were looking at recovery. And so I'm trained as an epidemiologist, so you have to think about study design as well. And so what I'm going to show you is these seven different mixing patterns, which we've talked about, the random mixing, the strict age or education mixing, and then the observed mixing we observed from the Seattle data set. And I'll be showing you basically a summary of 200 stochastic trials. So the first thing that we found was that the mixing, which is along the bottom here, random mixing had the lowest outbreak probability. And what that means is that if you try to introduce an infection into a network of people who are mixing randomly, it's not going to take off. 10% of the time, it'll only take off 10% of the time. 90% of the time, it won't take off. It'll die out on average. It'll burn itself out. The epidemic will not propagate itself. What you see is as you add either age mixing or education mixing or the combination of the two, as you get more structured mixing, the outbreak probability actually went up. These scenarios are identical except for the mixing strategy here. And so with the age and education strict mixing, the outbreak probability was approaching 60%. It's really, really high. I was very surprised by this. The second outcome is what we looked at was infection prevalence. And so what you see here is that, so again, we're comparing mixing schemes along the bottom. And what you see is that the infection prevalence was roughly the same in all of these different mixing schemes. So this is kind of good, because otherwise maybe you would think that some other, you might think that there would be a structural artifact. So this kind of makes sense to us. Now, the issue here is that we can then examine infection prevalence. We can break it down by age and education status, and that's along the bottom here. So we have 18 to 24-year-old women, and then their four education strata. The next group of 25 to 29-year-old women and their education strata, and so forth. And the whole point of this slide is just to show you that the infection prevalence in women, and it's the same in men, it's roughly the same regardless of age and education status. This does not conform with what we observed from the data. What we observed in the data is a strong age effect. So what does this mean? This means we need to go back to the drawing board and perhaps refine our theory. One way we can refine our theory is to impart these more complicated mixing schemes. And so here, you do see much more heterogeneous infection prevalence. So the population infection prevalence is the same, but how it's distributed is totally different. So this Gini coefficient thing is very relevant here. So we see a great bit of heterogeneity by age and education. When we look at the strict age and education mixing, it's even more heterogeneous. So I'll try to summarize. So what we've observed is that deviation from random proportionate mixing towards this more specific mixing preferences, this increases the probability that an epidemic will take off when it's introduced, and it also results in more heterogeneous prevalence, and the mixing alone in this case caused this disparity between these otherwise identical groups. Higher STD prevalence among younger age groups in this case, this resulted from not from riskier decision making, but rather the structural feature that this combination of assortative mixing by age and potentially education, and that those who are young are more likely to be in casual partnerships. So you might say, oh, but they're not. So this last part, oh, but they're not the same, because if the young are more likely to be in a casual partnership, does that make them more risky? Are they gonna, and I mean, you might have a different opinion. I would say no. I would say they're using the same decision metric. It's just that when you're young, you're not in a long-term partnership yet because you haven't found one. It's kind of the opposite side of the coin when you think about viral STDs. The age prevalence for viral STDs, as you get older and older, you're more likely to get a viral STD and you can't get rid of it. The same is true with these steady partnerships. They're on average 7 years long. Once you get one, you're not getting out. And so... So it's not a difference in decision making is the point. So some next steps that we're working on that I wasn't able to get done for the conference are looking at how this, so we've explained this mechanism. So how does this affect different interventions? And so one type of intervention we can look at is partner services in terms of contact tracing. So our hypothesis is that mixing patterns, random mixing versus structured mixing, random patterns affect the structure of the sexual network that's formed. And network shape affects the effectiveness of contact tracing, because if you have redundant linkages in the system, the signal will still get through. So if we trace a bunch of contacts, there's still other redundant links that allows the infection to flow through the system. And so our idea, what we're trying to show, is that is how this mixing is affected by how it affects these interventions. So with that, I will take your questions, if you have any.
Hi, thank you very much. Kath Mercer, University College London. Thanks very much. That's a great talk. I just want to pick up on the point you made right at the start about how models need good data.
Yeah.
And how you use data on the most recent partners from the Seattle Sex Survey. And my question is about how representative that is of the population of sexual partnerships.
Yeah.
Because we know that the most recent partnership is far more likely to be a regular partner than a casual partner. And so I'm interested in your thoughts,
yeah.
And I'm also like to challenge the audience that when we're thinking about looking at partnership level data, that we think beyond just looking at the most recent partner And I'm thinking about the NatCell data example. We look at the three most recent partners, and we turn that into a partnership level data. And I think we get a much richer data understanding of data on partnerships. So thank you for your question. You're
absolutely right about the issue of the most recent partnership only kind of biases what you're looking at. And so. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That we need more data is always the answer, and especially in this case.
Is that an option in the Seattle Sex Survey? Is it an option to look beyond just the most recent partner?
The numbers drop down.
Yeah.
So if you looked at all the sample sizes for all of the age and education groups, a lot of them were roughly 30, and I'm okay with that kind of size. But a lot of them were 5 or even 1. So of the 16 mixing matrices, some of them only had a sample size of either 1 or 16. There was only a couple of those. But so if we look at the second most recent partner, mm-hmm. that drops our sample size down from 1056 to like 800 or so. I don't remember.
But I just wonder whether you can perhaps think about your data differently, and so rather than thinking of a participant level, to turn it to a partnership level.
Well, so the other issue though is that, well, do we need to have a perfect representation to understand the phenomena that's going on? Is this representation that we have good enough? And so that's where really the sensitivity analysis, looking at the strict age and education mixing, which is not representative of our data at all. And we see similar phenomena, though, of the outbreak probability and the heterogeneous distribution of infection prevalence. Sure. Go ahead.
And one final thought. I think how people think about what's a casual partner and what's a regular partner is going to vary by age, just to throw it out there.
Well, I'm not sure those people knew they were they were initiating a casual.
Exactly. Yeah. So how we think about categorizing people into partnership types doesn't necessarily correspond to how people in the population think about partnership types. Thank you.
Yeah. Hi, Bob Cohn from San Francisco. I had kind of a technical question about your modeling.
Great.
It looked like you assumed that there was 5% of the population in your model. It was a core group.
Yeah.
And I was wondering why you picked 5% and whether you examined whether changing that proportion made a difference in terms of the odds of the epidemic taking off.
It would absolutely affect it. And I'm not sure if the difference between the outbreak probabilities would differ. I would imagine it would be a similar story, but the actual values would definitely be different. Why we chose that value, number one, prior models, which Professor Lowe here, she compared a bunch of these individual-based models to one another, and we were basing this one off of a specific Martina Morris model. And I believe they assumed 5% for that. In addition, though, when we looked at our Seattle data set, there was reason to think that number was reasonable, but it's definitely one of these parameter values that should be varied and considered.
Yeah, again, I was wondering how sensitive it was.
Yeah.
Okay.
I can't answer that right now.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Kathy Hsu, Massachusetts Department of Public Health. Two questions for you. That was excellent. Caused me to think a lot. One question is related to the possibility of the addition of a race-ethnicity variable in terms of the numbers of, I can see almost the stack replicating into a 3D portion of that, and whether or not that would make a difference, say, in other settings outside of Seattle, which, if I understand their demographics, maybe you don't have as much data related to that.
Yeah. I think the general statement that we can say from this is that more structured mixing can lead to greater potential disparity. And so regardless of how you define the dimensions that people are mixing upon, be it age, education, race, or something else, geography, I mean, whatever, if people are expressing a great preference for certain types of partners, that can lead to pools of risk that are concentrated for no other reason than this mixing phenomena alone.
Does
that answer your question?
Yeah, it does.
Okay.
And I'm just sort of thinking about how that would additionally help other program areas, maybe in terms of thinking about the approach to these things. The second question I have is actually triggered by what's happening in real time in several jurisdictions, if not nationally, in terms of downturns in disease and predictive value for these models in terms of what could be going on there. So, for example, it's not a true downturn, but for the first time in our jurisdiction, we only had a 3% rise in our reporting of chlamydia in 2013, I believe. So rather than having a 10% increase every year, and the model and how that might account for it, and I know it's still only a model and it's in its infancy, but I'm sort of also thinking about the projection of models for outbreak remission as well as ongoing transmission.
So, yeah, to rephrase that, the probability of extinction is what you mean, right?
Yeah.
And so that's another good outcome. I didn't look at that. We could measure that as well. But in general, once these things take off, they take off. And it's when you're close to the reproductive number of one. If it's exactly one, you're producing exactly one new case. Each infection is producing one new case. So when you're close to that value of one, that's when you're close to this region of perhaps stochastic die-off that you're talking about. And we were also close to one, but we had a large enough sample size. So this was among 10,000 people. Each simulation was 10,000 people mixing together. And because of that adequate sample size, even with the low R0, we didn't see die-off once it lasted for 20 years or so, which is a longer time scale than you're concerned with, I'm sure.
Right. Then it becomes endemic.
Yeah. I think a way to analyze that would be to looking at more realistic sexual network sizes, not in the thousands, but in the hundreds. Then an outcome like probability of extinction would make a lot more sense.
Hi. I was wondering about the way that the model is dealing with the difference between casual and study partnerships, in the sense that we know that a lot of the time, depending on how people perceive their partnerships, their behavior, like whether they use condoms or not, is going to end up affecting disease transmission. So I was just wondering if you guys had taken that into account at all.
We did take it into account in two ways. So one way is that the frequency of sex was higher in the casual partnerships.
Right, I saw that.
And so, but like you're saying, if people are judging their partners based on risk, if they're saying, oh, you're risky because this is a casual thing, they're more likely to use condoms. Like, does that outweigh the frequency issue? I don't know. But we could have just let them have the same same transmission rate, but I would need to conduct the sensitivity analysis, but I don't think that these results would be sensitive to that.
Thanks. Sharmista again. That was great, Ian. That was awesome work. And just have a question about the mixing matrix that you would get after, like at equilibrium, for example, at your simulation. So sort of what you showed us, I think, was your decision rules that went in, right?
The what? Can you get closer to the mic?
Oh.
Yeah, sorry.
Bring it down a bit. The mixing matrix that your model output would produce at equilibrium, for example, was it different from your inputs in terms of your choices, because you're losing people when they get into these study partnerships,
very
et cetera.
Good. Yeah, no, that's very good. So I showed you the demographic before and after, and I didn't show you the partnership stuff. They were roughly similar, but we didn't. I would have to look at it in more detail, but that's important to show, and that was omitted here for sure.